Sounds great. Sounds perfect. Right. Yeah.
Let me that's what they pay you for.
Yeah. This is awesome. I'm a big fan of what you do. So, yeah, really exciting. So let me see actually just one second. I just want to make sure everything's recording in place.
Absolutely.
Yeah, just checking the sound levels into the DAW. Yeah, it sounds good. So how's it going?
It's going great. Oh, I guess I'm supposed to say more. It's going great. I'm having a fun time. I'm over here digitizing D-Expeditions from the 1980s. I'm just about done with these tapes. They are VHS tapes that are essentially, back in the 20s and the 30s, you'd have the big game hunters and the rich guys go off, rent a boat, go to like Tuvalu or to some Mexican offshore island, and they would need a cell phone. So the cell phone you would get would be a ham radio operator.
Right.
And he would have a little station set up and he would order supplies or check weather or do whatever his work was. Well, after a while, they didn't need those people anymore, but the ham radio operators kind of dug being on weird little boats or flying to tiny countries. So they just kept doing it and they called them D-Expeditions. And these are essentially home movies. It's essentially, look, we're on a crazy boat. We're going to the uninhabited Sandwich Islands and we're, and then what they would do is that they would then like try to reach as many other hams around the world. So those hams could get QSL cards, which is the thing where you say, hi, I'm talking to you. Here's my call sign. Cool. I'm talking to you. Here's my call sign. And then you would postcard mail each other to go, I've talked to somebody from that part of the country in the world. And you'd have a wall full of all the conversations you've had. So it was like a cheap way for people to add, you know, oh, there's going to be a D-Expedition on May 5th. Call up and you'll be able to, you know, you'll be there on this frequency. And then you're going to get a card in the mail mailed from Tuvalu saying that you talked to somebody from Tuvalu. So these videos are absolutely weirdly valuable and weirdly valueless. You know, if you look at them as pure, is this what it's like now? It's like, no, now it's all going to be 4K recorded on iPhones. But this is like what Tuvalu was like in 1988. What was it like to travel back then when nobody had any cell phones? How did people, you know, walk around and meet others and everything else? So it's like this time capsule buried in among a ham radio tape. So anyway,
that's incredible. You can always,
it's, you know, a lot of the stuff with the archive, which we'll talk about, is like, well, here's what it is if you just look at the surface. And then here's all the ancillary tangential approaches, you know. The Wayback Machine is one where now everybody understands the value. But at the time, it seems weird that Brewster and his group would be, let's keep a copy of Yahoo every 2 days of the directory. Like, that's a weird, wasteful data hoard. And now people are like, do you have anything of my early youth? I was a kid who was playing these things. You know, when we made Flash emulated in the browser, and you know, Flash's heyday is like basically like 98 to about 2010. And for a certain generation now, you know, for many of them, if their parents couldn't afford video game consoles, their video game console was being on the family computer or the school computer, going to a Flash site and playing video games.
That was
so
me.
For them. Yeah. The emotional connection to Homestar Runner, or being able to play Newgrounds games or Kongregate games or others, is like huge. But if you were to say to somebody for whom they're before that or after that, they're like, what's the meaningful value in all this? It's like, you know, there's a couple that transcend the time, you know, like Leek Spin or Caramel Dansen, or you play like a really well-made Tom Fulp Newgrounds game, like one of the Pico games or whatever, or Nico games, where you would say, my God, this is a full-ass video game. What a fantastic thing. But the other 5,000 that we've recovered, I get it if people are like, why? Why was this important? I'm like, you're 13. It's free. Your parents aren't going to pick you up till 4 p.m. and they're letting you stay in the computer room until they drive in.
That's amazing. Yeah, no, that's great. It's funny, ham radio, it was something that I was really interested in for a while. And I just wanted to say, maybe introduce you. This is Jason Sure. Scott. He is probably one of the, he's an internet archivist and works for the Great Internet Archive. And you're also a filmmaker as well. And, you know, I just wanted to say, like, a lot of the imagery and the research documents that I use for my show come from the Internet Archive. It's the number one resource for me in terms of research value, imagery value. You know, I do these like sort of collage type covers in a sort of Abby Warburg-esque way. And, you know, that kind of frames a compendium for the things that I'm interested in researching. And early on in this project, I was finding French cyber hacker manuals and using imagery from there. And I was getting all this inspiration. And I think what you guys do, it's probably the most important thing on the internet. And when you say something like, what's the point in archiving this stuff? It's, I think the value in pre-social media, digital media is very, very important. It's increasingly important as these exabytes of data. It's important to remember a different period of digitized life, I think, especially just sort of like tears washed away in rain. And so, yeah, thank you for what you do. This is a pleasure.
Yeah, you know, when you work in this kind of area, so the archive right now is at about 150 petabytes.
Of wow.
Stuff, right?
That's a of which, lot.
Yeah, like 40 of it is the Wayback Machine. And then there's all these other, you know, scanned materials and, you know, books and software and movies and you name it. Music, of course, tons and tons of it. And it's been interesting to me. Well, first of all, I totally understand that the Internet Archive has this weird branding problem, which is they create the Wayback Machine in 2002, and it is an automatic killer app. It is like a search engine. What if we have a search engine for the past? Like, clearly, that is the winning ticket. It is half of all of our traffic. People coming in, I need to see what this person said 5 years ago. I need to know what this company was that's now out of business. I need to understand blah, 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 blah. It's like it just sells itself. If you said to somebody, you need a snapshot of what this website was like in 1997. Okay, go here. You can see it. Wow, that's great. What did it change? And, you know, over years, they have added little features like diffs. So you can actually say like what changes have happened between here and there. And it does a pretty good job. And there's a bunch of that, right? Like that's the killer app. Like a lot of restless people who have a lot of money, the founder of the archive, Brewster Kahle, has tried various experiments over the years that are kind of in many ways tangential to that mission. And in some cases, they've taken off and they're so well taken off, we don't imagine a world without them. And then other times it's like, oh yeah, that didn't work out at all. And it's very funny because if you take something like the company Atari and you look at like the first 5 or 6 years of Atari, yeah, they're looking at medical devices. They're looking at calculators, at dance hall, light and sound, you know, like they're trying all these things. And it turned out, nope, video games, computer games, and then later selling plushies of same. And like, that's it. That's like how it worked out. But there was definitely this urge to go, what else do we do? And so like, I joined the Internet Archive. And the Internet Archive, for people who don't know, was started by this person, Brewster Kahle, as a co-founder back in 1996 as a side project because he had just sold his company, Alexa Internet, to Amazon for a couple $100 million of Amazon stock in 1996. And so now he doesn't have to wait in line and he doesn't have to worry about, you know, where is he going to sleep? And he doesn't have to really worry about anything, right? And he does a bunch of things here and there and a couple weird bits, but he also rents a building in the Presidio and starts to build this idea of like, well, what if we had information available this way? What if we did this? What if we did this? And he hires a set of people, and they kind of put together this kind of rambunctious, let's put Data up. Alexa Internet can be defined, and I've discovered, by the way, this doesn't land with everybody. It was the Nielsen ratings for the internet. It still is. But people don't remember what Nielsen ratings are, so then I have to go explain that. And I'm like, oh, to keep track of television viewership, there were these things called Nielsen ratings that would tell them, oh, that show All in the Family or Star Trek last night, it got 3 million viewers. Like, you have to do that using phone calls and boxes attached to representative viewers. It's big money, like, to get the nightly, like, I want to know, start a business tomorrow. How well did our show do? How well did our lineup do? How well did we do everything? And, like, so that's big, big, big business. Well, Brewster did that along with Bruce and the other people for websites. You are the 110th most popular political website this month.
Right.
And so Amazon bought that and paid a good amount of money for it. And Brewster suddenly has left that. But one of the things he negotiated was to be able to track what's the most popular political website, what's the story of it. They're keeping archives of these websites that they've scanned. And he said, could I keep that, like, with a 6-month embargo? And they were like, okay. So that was one of the conditions. So he's getting snapshots of the web for like 5 or 6 years, put onto like tape. And it was in 2002. He was like, could we like play it back like a videotape machine? Could we kind of like review websites, like how they looked in this year and this year? And they create the Wayback Machine. And that just expands to the stratosphere, right?
Right.
So now the Internet Archive is the Wayback Machine, and the Wayback Machine is the Internet Archive. But Brewster's restless. He is like, well, what else could we do? So then he looks into the fact that, like, there's a filmmaker, and really more a film historian and archivist, named Rick Prelinger. And Rick Prelinger has been spending 30 years saving old government films and preserving cinema. And he's getting his hands on these public domain government films, Duck and Cover, Hygiene and You, how to deal with, you know, fascism, how to deal with your gun, how to be a good, you know, citizen, and so on. And he's like, I've got nowhere really to host this. And Brewster's like, I guess I'll host it, which sounds very simple.
Right.
But in 2002, that's insane that he's going to host literal gigabytes of video for free on the internet. So suddenly that place is doing a video demonstration. And if you use the Wayback Machine to look back at the Internet Archive itself, which I've done, it really does feel like a weird incubator. It feels kind of like OpenAI feels now, where they're like, we're a dessert topping. We're a floor wax. We're a football team. We're a, you know, like, it's like this weird, like, we're going to do culinary work, we're gonna do whatever. Or if you want to be, you know, another one, it's like Uber with like Uber Eats, Uber rental car, Uber whatever, Uber sales. Like, it felt like a kind of a conflagration of weird side projects, including the Wayback Machine. At some point, there's a bunch of Grateful Dead tapers who, due to an agreement with the Grateful Dead, can put up tapes of performances, and they're like, where do we host it? Brewster goes, how about with me? And so that's how the Live Music Archive pops up. So suddenly we're doing audio. And then Brewster's like,
so it started with the Grateful Dead tapes?
Yeah.
That was the first. Yeah. Okay. Wow.
Yeah. To the point now, I believe we only are missing 200 Grateful Dead performances, somewhere in that number. It's triple digits and very low. And then there was this, like, there was a real crazy thing a bunch of years ago where the Grateful Dead's management was like, you can't have anything up. And like the Live Music Archive and Brewster and the management and then members of Grateful Dead all got together in a room and they walked it back to don't do from the soundboard recordings, which they allowed, you know, don't put those up. put up everything else. All the other live recordings can stay. So it was like they negotiated, and the tipping point was the Grateful Dead members were like, yeah, sure. No, there's no problem here. This is great. And that live music archive has now expanded into a whole other range of live music. So now we're in audio. And then one day Brewster's like, wouldn't it be neat to be able to read books online? And that ultimately became like the book scanning project, but also became a way to be given PDFs or images of pages or documents and make them readable in the browser. Movies, obviously, from Prelinger, then expand into other open collections. Now, I joined in 2011. So the archive has been around, you know, what's that, like 15 years, something like that. And I'm nuts. Now, when I joined, it was like Brewster and I are about 10 years apart in age. He came up through MIT. I came up through Emerson College. He comes from a well-off family. I come from a middle-class family. And we're both from New York, which I think is very funny. Although you cannot hear that in his voice at all. He has destroyed it out in the West Coast. I still sound like where I come from. And when I joined, a lot of people were like, they assumed I already worked there. And unfortunately, sometimes people think I founded the Internet Archive, and I'm like, no. Oh, no. No, I know the calls we get. I know the pressures that he's under. No, I'm happy-go-lucky guy who looks out into the world. Now, I'm going to jump forward for you. I'm going to jump forward and say, Brewster's interesting saving grace as a CEO, because he is a tech CEO from the Valley. He has a lot of potential to not do good.
Right. And I was going to ask.
Yeah, he does do good.
Yeah, yeah. I agree 100%. But he's like such a rare example of somebody, of a venture capitalist who actually did something good and didn't create a Ponzi scheme. He wasn't, you know, bankrupting Silicon Valley Bank. He wasn't doing this, you know, stuff that we associate VC money laundering scenes. He actually created a public utility. This is when laissez-faire capitalism kind of goes correct, which I don't think is that often.
But I don't think it's often at all. And when I give, he doesn't like to talk about being rich. I, of course, do nothing but talk about how rich he is. And the reason that I do is because I'm like, when I give tours, whenever they're stupid enough to let me do the tours, I'll be like, this guy could make a phone call and a black helicopter would take him to an island that's not on any map where he could watch endangered species fight to the death and eat the winner. Like, he's got all this money. He could totally take himself out of the social contract, take himself out of society. He could, you know, be on a boat. He loves boats. He could just be drifting from boat to boat to boat location, like a lot of billionaires do, where it's like they're going to be in Cannes at this point, and they're going to be in this set of islands at this point. They're going to be in this. Like, he could just follow the weather, live the life he wants, have a staff of 50 whose job is to make sure he never thinks about what color socks he's wearing. He could do all that. He could have done that. Instead, he dumped money in such interesting directions. There's like at least 4 or 5 albums out there that would not be made if he didn't just quietly give them money. Like, I don't, Whoa. You know, I'm not entitled to tell you which. And I mean, they're not, none of them are like, you know, Toby Keith or Taylor Swift. This is like art bands and others who he came into the same orbit of, and they were like, yeah, if we only had a few more thousand, we could get our album mastered. And he's like, here, master your album. And, you know, he doesn't even want to be thanked. Somebody told me that he offered $1 million to his fraternity at MIT if they would go co-ed, which they did not, but he was like, give you $1 million if you just go co-ed.
That's so funny, because it seems like so much of, especially the arts, there's a real sort of ideological agenda that gets pushed by politicians when they give various artists money. You know, like when you looked at the World Expos, there was a very sort of serious, like, geopolitical agenda of soft power that was being on a global scale. But it's kind of interesting, because I don't know politically, if it's like copy left stuff. I don't want to reduce it to this kind of like libertarian thing. And honestly, the politics of it aren't really that interesting right. to me. That's not what I'm interested in. I'm interested in like how it serves as a public utility, especially for new generations of people getting into archiving, how it fits in with the broader framework of library science.
Yeah. And I want to say, you know, one of the, just to drill down this far, two things. First of all, I'm from New York, buddy. I spent a couple years going, is this a front?
Right.
Is this a front? Is this a tax dodge? Is yeah. this a trick? Is this, yeah, I can put a little bow on here, but as a result, I can write off A, B, and C, and D and be able to own this much property. No. Nope. I drilled so far down through so many people. Literally, Brewster is like, how about if I spend the rest of my life not being a jerk? And like, so that's clear, right? I also totally understand anybody who's clenching their fist listening to this, that every, you know, multi-hundred millionaire is a failure of society, that it allows that to happen. Like, absolutely, I agree with you. Yes, ideally there should not be, definitely not billionaires, and probably not 100 millionaires, and probably not 10 millionaires. Like, you shouldn't have so much money that the money makes more money than the fortune of many other people's hard work on a monthly basis. Like, the fact that those pharaohs choose to do good or do bad doesn't, to me, either damn them or bless them fundamentally. It's like you give a sociopathic incel $500 million and he does terrible things with it. You're like, yeah, why did we let society give this person $500 million? Like, where did we fail? Can we fix that? So, like, I get that. And so when I'm seeing Brewster do really good things, it's because there was this randomness in the stock market that allowed this incredible amount of money to go in. And taxes in America have been spent certain ways in such that people are very resistant to paying taxes in the United States. So as a result, there is not great incentive to pass laws for greater taxes because we're not showing that we do things with it. And or now people are so powerful, blah, blah, blah. I'm saying that right. like societarily, I'm so pleased to be under Brewster Kahle's wing as I have been for 13 years. And I am so impressed with some of the projects he's experimented with the work he does. But so much of it is clearly like, government should be doing this. Like, he bought a building to put employees in. It's a separate entity.
It's not the church.
No, we have guest rooms in the church, but there's a separate building that he bought with the idea being he did some research and he discovered that for many of the Bay Area employees, 70% of their income was going to housing. So that is a problem. How do I fix it? Let's try an experiment where I buy a building and we have apartments in there and certain people can live there for much, much less under market conditions, you know, sub $1,000 apartments. And how will that work? Yeah. And how will that work? And the answer is it's okay. But, you know, the fact is company housing is company housing. There's a reason why they don't do that. And it's not, it's not tied to your job at the archive, but you know what I mean? Like, it's like cute experiment. Or he tried doing a credit union for the employees. He's tried, you know, I'll give you an example. My favorite example of the opposite of person coughs, we all get the flu, is Brewster shrugs and somebody goes to paradise, is Brewster was into Bitcoin when it was nothing. Like, when it was like, whoa, let's do decentralized money. And it didn't become the literal circle of hell that it is now, right? But it was like back when it was like, literally in the same way of thinking of like containerization of Linux machines. Like,
exactly. It was more of a technical process.
Yeah. How do we get one machine to act like three machines? Like, how would we do that? In the same way, it was like, what if we made computers do Sudoku so you can buy heroin? Wouldn't that be neat? So Brewster just messed around with it.